All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight we're going to be talking about the 2001 film Conspiracy. I know you got your hopes up that it would be the Val Kilmer film from 2008 with a 4% Rotten Tomatoes score. But no, it's not the Val Kilmer film. This is an HBO BBC film starring Kenneth Branagh and the guy from Downton Abbey, which is a great show. I really, really enjoyed watching that with my wife. So anyway, Robert, how you doing? This is episode 195 of the show. People can find this at actualanarchy.com/195. Let's check in with you, see how things are going in the pandemic.
It's too damn hot. Back to you.
All right. And there we have it. It's too damn hot during this pandemic. Apparently, the virus can't survive in the sunshine and the hot. So it really should benefit you and your too damn hot region there, Robert.
Yeah, well, you know, I appreciate that. That would be nice if people calmed the F down. But no, virus hysteria is still gripped the nation, including in my little backwater area. And it doesn't show any sign of abating anytime soon. I think as long as the mainstream media continues to shove it down people's throats, that this is the biggest threat to life, that they'll go along with just about anything to protect themselves, except, you know, stay home. They won't do that. They'll go out into public and then make sure everybody else is doing what they want them to.
Yeah, you know, there's someone named J.P. Sears. He's been doing some really great videos. He just got kicked off of YouTube, I think, a little while ago. But he was recently doing a video where he was like, all right, the things we got to do to be healthy is social distance, wear masks, stay inside, and avoid the sun. And he's like, nothing to do with boosting your immune system, getting exercise, eating healthy, any of that stuff. So he was making a lot of fun of it. It was really quite good. So I'll post that on our show notes page because I think he does some great work over there. And I think that this is an example of, you know, a lot of times people will ask, how did normal people go along with Hitler and what he was pushing to do in this movie, Conspiracy? And I think we're seeing it right now. You scare the populace enough to where they will think they're doing a good thing and they end up doing bad things when they, you know, collectivize their activity and think they're being noble when in fact they've lost kind of the ability to rationally think this through and they just kind of follow orders. So I think that'll kind of play into our discussion here tonight. What do you think?
Yeah. Back then it was their enemy was the Jews or gypsies or other undesirables like homosexuals and whatnot. But here today, it's the virus. As long as there's an enemy, then you will get a certain part of the population, apparently the majority, that will just go along with whatever the perceived authority says needs to happen. And then they'll make the emotional decision, and then they will be wedded to that decision, and they will defend it in the face of all rational thought. It's quite fun.
Right. And any contrary evidence or contrary experts or contrary anything just falls right off their back and they stick to their original positions. That's not necessarily a thing that is exclusive to this particular issue or those particular people who adhere to the fear-mongering that is displayed on CNN constantly with the death clock over in the left-hand side of the screen that they do there. But it does seem to be a thing related to just the nature of most humans in general who pay just enough attention but not enough to really parse things through and come to a real understanding of what's being promoted and what the issue at hand happens to be.
Indeed, Daniel. Indeed.
All right. Well, enough pontificating for me. We're going to get into the last night of sports in the show and introduce our very fine guest. He's a returning guest, and we'll meet him again in just a moment. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson. We are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. Check it out at thelaunchpadmedia.com. You can also find this episode, where we're going to be talking about conspiracy, over at lastnighters.com/138, because this is the 138th episode of this here fine show. Well, I use fine in quotes, scare quotes, because we're kind of middling at best. However, we have a great guest who's more than middling. He's great. He's a returning guest. He's been on with us a couple of times, most recently for Soylent Green. He is Dr. Dennis Foster. He is a professor of economics, if I recall, in the great state of Arizona. And welcome back to the show, Dennis. We really appreciate the conversations we've had with you, not only Soylent Green, but also The Day the Earth Stood Still, the Keanu Reeves version, and the original from Black and White Days.
Yes, that's right. It's a pleasure to be back with you to talk about this particular movie. But the ideas, that are presented, I think, are, like you mentioned, should resonate with people even today, and really in a way that they're not as far-fetched as you might think.
Yeah, I think that's well said. We were mentioning that in some of the pre-show content available for our Patreon supporters. You can check it out at lastnighters.com/Patreon to get a piece of that. We also do a thing called Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is bonus content after the show, where we cut a little bit looser for pretty much as long as our guests can stick around, and sometimes even longer than that. So you're more than welcome to stay as long as you'd like. You can wear out your welcome, Dennis. We're totally good with that. So anyway, where we kick off this show usually is with the old Google description. And so I got to, I think I'm sharing it. Yeah, I have the ability to share it. Let me see here. I'm trying a new thing here on the show. This is the Google description. I'm adding it to the stream. And let me see. This is really great content, by the way. So Conspiracy came out in 2001. It's a war/drama film, 1 hour and 36 minutes. It was a joint effort by HBO and the BBC. It got a 7.7 on the IMDb, 100% Rotten Tomatoes. And dog whistling, 88% of Google users like this movie. The description is, in January 1942, as the United States enters World War II, a conference assembles near Berlin. SS General Heydrich, played by Kenneth Branagh, and his associate Lieutenant Eichmann, played by Stanley Tucci, call the meeting to discuss the evacuation of Germany's Jews and other undesirables, a code word for the extermination in concentration camps. To begin this final solution, they must change the mind of a small group of men opposed to the idea, led by Chancellor Kritzinger, played by David Threlfall. And came out May 19, 2001. Director is Frank Pearson. This was based on transcripts that survived one copy, and it was supposed to have been destroyed. So that is the Google description, and we'll go to Robert for your initial take and opening salvo, please.
Well, first of all, I love the name of this movie. It seems like everybody believes in conspiracies, but people don't like to admit it necessarily. And the conspiracies they do believe in are legitimate, real. They're not actual conspiracies, but then the ones that they don't believe in are kooky tinfoil hat stuff. But all conspiracies are just two or more people in a room having a conversation about committing a crime. And what is this film about but a group of men sitting around a table talking about committing a horrific, massive crime? So that was a great title for the film on the, I don't know whose decision that was, the director or whatever, but really enjoy that. The film itself is quite engaging for what could essentially just be a one-act play, guys standing around a table, sitting around a table, talking about all the ins and outs of what to do about the Jewish problem that they face themselves with. It's very much an example of the banality of evil. These are just bureaucrats talking about something they got to do. And they could be talking about the grain harvest and the shortfall there, but instead they're talking about the ins and outs and the numbers and the logistics of how you kill millions and millions of people. And it's quite revealing in how the bureaucracy allows for horrific evil, because it's just people doing their jobs. They've been given a task by somebody who they believe has the authority to tell them to do it. And so therefore they're just perfectly justified in doing this great thing they see for their country to rid themselves of this menace. There's many times in the film where they seem to think that they are acting defensively, that they need to protect not only their culture, but the actual, their way of life. But they don't really explain how, you know, of course they never explain exactly how the Jews are attacking them. And that's one way to play the victim. Just leave it very, very vague how you're under attack, but just you're under attack, so we can defend ourselves. So, it's a fascinating film. I don't know exactly how accurate all, of course, the dialogue's probably fairly invented, but there is a summary of the events that survived, like you said. It's regardless of how it all, the details, how it all played out, we do know that there was actually a conference. They did discuss this, and then the end result is what it is. So we do know that there was a group of men who actually sat around a table discussing how they are going to logistically solve this millions and millions of murder situation. So.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting opening take, and there's a lot to unpack there. I also noticed that in this particular movie, it seemed as if this was also a dissection of a power grab, and that this meeting was more of a ruse to subtly and in an intimidating fashion let the other players who thought that they had a say in this, that this is already predetermined and you're merely here to hear that we're in charge now. The SS is now in charge, and we're going to give you the sort of the thinking that you're going to have an opinion that's going to be heard and possibly sway the decision, but it's not really. And we're also going to make you complicit in this. So we're all in this together now. So I think that's kind of piggybacks onto your take. And Dennis, we'll go to you for your take on the Google information and what we've already opened with.
Well, I would agree with both of you about some of the comments that you've made. The idea here is that there's this sort of unmovable bureaucracy, or not unmovable, it's unstoppable. It's moving in a certain direction. It doesn't just start with, you know, how do we kill 11 million Jews? It's the next sort of, I hate to say it, but it's like the next logical step. And they reference that in the movie a couple of times, and we might get a chance to talk about this a little bit. That in fact they tried to expel Jews, and they weren't especially successful. There's a kind of a famous story about 1939, where a ship of almost 1,000 refugees, mostly Jews, were turned back from Miami. They weren't allowed to dock. They were sent back to Europe, and it's like. And this is referenced in the story that, you know, there's countries, they just won't take them. And it's like, well, we tried to get rid of them this way. We tried to get rid of them that way. And so, you know, now this is our sort of final solution, right? As they call it. And I think that's important to kind of recognize that it doesn't just come out of left field, that it is part of sort of the way in which this unfolds over many years. The impersonal nature of it, I mean, you've commented about that, is what one of the things I find quite startling and revealing in the movie, that you can take such a horrific sort of idea and yet kind of sugarcoat it into just, well, what do we need to do next? You know, well, what we need to do next is we need to find a way to ship everybody to the East. And to draw an unfair analogy, we can say that in terms of today, well, why don't we just make everybody wear a mask? And why is that different in a sort of philosophical way? And the answer is it isn't. It represents the same kind of power over people that governments want to have and try to have. And of course, in this case here, it's illustrated quite well.
Right. Yeah, I'd agree with that wholeheartedly. And I think that it's interesting that they're going through this in a very bureaucratic and like almost like we just have this problem we have to deal with. So they've dehumanized the people, yet it still affects the soldiers who are like doing the evacuation. That's another thing they do. They change the meaning of words in that very Orwellian sense. So they went from a policy of emigration, like you were saying, where they were trying to send them out of the country to other countries to take them, and they were turned away. They even mentioned the United States turning them away. So they made reference to potentially that Miami incident you were talking about. But what I've never really understood what was the motivation, because all we ever hear about is how evil Hitler was and how evil the Nazis were and how they dehumanized Jewish people. But we don't know why, or I don't know why, I guess, is what would be a better thing. Like, I don't understand why. The only thing I've ever really heard is that he just chose a scapegoat to blame all the problems on to be a focal point for this like common enemy sort of phenomena that would then rally people behind him in this sort of populist effort. And I think that's where modern day people would say, oh, Trump's like Hitler because he's being populist and he's doing these policies that are going to galvanize people who aren't like really critically thinking about this issue. But it's just to like have an enemy to focus on to gain power. But is there more to it than that?
Well, I'm sure Dennis knows way more than I do about this, but I'm going to take a little tiny little whack at it and just say that I suspect that the Treaty of Versailles left Germany in a massive economic devastated state, and the Jews are predominantly represented among banking. And I guess you could easily kind of put the blame on that sector. I don't know if that's necessarily the case, but I'm sure that's probably one of the reasons, or at least maybe one of the core reasons. And then a whole bunch of other reasons were led into that. You know, Jews, especially like Ashkenazi, or not Ashkenazi, what's the Hasidic ones? They don't really integrate into a culture. They kind of have their own. They stick to their own. They do their own thing, kind of like the Amish do. And maybe if they are seen as an enemy and then like, look, they're not even trying to integrate, be part of German society. They're like this other thing that comes in and then does all these terrible things and like takes our wealth and doesn't like give it back to us. I could see that could be twisted and used, but I'm sure Dennis, you probably have a more nuanced view of this and could smack down my dumb ideas.
Well, I mean, I agree. I think it's mostly just a scapegoat. I mean, they're saying, well, we want to preserve the German culture and the German people in even an extreme view in terms of the blood of Germany. And so I guess you might say that who is it that has actually, I wouldn't say that they haven't tried to integrate. I mean, certainly some haven't, but to the extent that they have integrated into German society, then they become a focal point of sort of general disagreement and disillusionment, and it becomes an easy target. And if I think Robert, you mentioned earlier that they also were killing gypsies, and they were killing homosexuals, and so I think really Jews just stood out as sort of the number one outside influence that they can get rid of. But they have a whole long list of outside influences that they want to get rid of, and you know this is the one that they kind of focus on. If I could go back for a second, one of the points that kind of interests me about this whole story is whether or not it wasn't just as you mentioned, Daniel, a power play to some extent, and maybe a power play by Heydrich, that he was given the vague general direction by Göring. In fact, the story is that the letter that he reads at the beginning of the conference, he reads the letter that authorizes him to, you know, seek out the final solution. The letter was actually written by Heydrich, if I'm saying his name right, and not by Göring. Göring just signed it. And so it raises the issue of whether or not this is just like part of his play, maybe with Himmler, who was always conniving to do things to advance his political stature and you know, his power. And so this may have been another one of those kinds of roles that's being played here that, you know, we kind of lose sight of, and we just think of, well, like they use the term evacuate instead of kill. Well, is that, I mean, who are they fooling? I mean, we aren't seeing any of these notes. It's not being published in the British newspapers or anything. So why don't they just say kill? And it's like, well, maybe it's because there are internal conflicts, and that's kind of what we're also seeing that are unfolding in this story.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, because when they talked about the soldiers having morale issues with shooting women and children, they sort of showcase the idea that you need to dehumanize, not only for the sake of the people following the orders, but for the people giving the orders. Like, you need to change the language so it's more palatable to be able to do these horrendous acts, even to make, you know, peace with themselves, who are the ones sort of calling the shots in this. And I think that kind of plays into, you know, just the psychology of it, because it's not just the propaganda arm that you need to get people who are going to be, you know, in the populace, like hating another group or blaming things on them, but you also need to get your own self to get over your humanity of what you're doing and the morality of it. Because I think it really played into, I know, Robert, you want to jump in here, but like the one guy, Mr. Bates from Downton Abbey, was like, I wrote these laws. These laws are paramount. We can't like destroy these laws or defile these laws. It's going to create this bureaucratic nightmare. And I actually agreed with the big fat guy, Coppler, I want to say, who was like, just change the laws. You're the one writing them. Why not just change them? Now, I'm not saying that that's how like society should be run. What I'm saying is the laws are such bullshit to begin with. What does it matter if you're going to change them? Because you're clinging to this idea of, well, it's the law, as if it's sort of this moral shield to this horrendous shit you're doing. You know, slavery was legal. Exterminating the Jews was legal, right? As a result of this this Wannsee conference. So like, just because something is law doesn't mean it's morally correct. Robert, jump in.
Right. And well, I think you got it wrong with the, it wasn't Mr. Bates who said that. It was the heartthrob guy, lawyer dude.
Oh, that's right. Colin Firth.
That's right. That's the dude. But yeah, that was all interesting. That whole discussion about the law and how the Germans were very much beholden to the law. We recently did Casablanca, where the Germans in that film were very much, now we need to do this by the letter of the law. Even if we made up this law and it's a bunch of BS, we're still following the law. So you can't say we're, you know, we're lawbreakers or whatever. But in this movie, like you said, the big fat guy, he goes, we make the law we need. And that I think that's the quote you're alluding to. One quote that I liked by the soldier guy that was stationed in Poland, I think, who had killed like 28,000 Jews. One of the other characters asks him, you know, what have you learned from all your time as a soldier? And he's like, to have a healthy distrust, or to have a distrust of language, or something like that. It was something along those lines. And I think that kind of points to what you're talking about, that the politicians dress up all these horrific things in florally language. And at one point, the main general guy, he says that, what does he say? He goes, soldiers require the skill to do the unthinkable. Politicians require the skill to get others to do the unthinkable for you. So the politicians will dress up horrific things in very palatable language and very pro us kind of terms, or we're being attacked kind of terms. But it's really actually, when you break down what's actually happening, of course, it's horrifically immoral and just outright evil. But yeah, it's fascinating to watch otherwise, you know, normal people buy into this. I mean, nobody's born evil. They have to be propagandized, and they have to go, oh, this is what we're doing now. And no, this is what we're doing now. The guy that we all think is awesome says we got to kill 11 million people. So how do we do it? All right, what do we do? And then next thing you know, you're a monster. And the fact that most of these guys were prosecuted or sort of very light sentences or didn't get prosecuted at all is all pretty pretty scandalous. The little end bit at the end of the movie was very disappointing. Only what? Himmler or wasn't him, the main guy.
Eichmann?
Eichmann was like the only guy who was like caught. And then a few other guys were like went to trial, but only served like light sentences. Other guys were like released on, like we couldn't find any evidence to hold this guy. It was all.
Yeah. The Koppler guy, the really fat guy, he lived until like the 1980s and he was like a tax accountant. And I was surprised by that. Oh, yeah. Like if he really was this like super unhealthy looking guy in 1942, I can't imagine he lived another 40 plus years.
Well, yeah. But, and he would have been like what, in his early 20s, like super early 20s. So these high up general types, these are all young kids in the military and they just get like promoted or selected. And these are like very, very young men deciding horrific things, like with very little perspective on life and wisdom.
Yeah. Actually, I don't think many of them were young at this meeting. I think like almost every one of them had fought in World War One.
Oh, really? Mm. So no way he lived till the 80s and he fought in World War One.
That Koppler guy, it said he lived till like 1982 or 84 or something like that.
He said 86.
Oh, 86. Okay.
Maybe 40 years later.
Maybe he lived till he's 90 something.
Well, you only had to be born in about 1900 to be in World War II or World War One.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he could have been in his 80s. I suppose that's possible. Okay. He just didn't look like the healthiest guy. He had like a McDonald's diet.
Well, and that's the actor. So I don't know exactly what the real person looked like. There was another movie done on this same subject in 1984. It's all in German with English subtitles. And it's also very kind of compelling. But that character, although he's bigger than everybody else, he's not as obese as the guy playing the role in this particular movie.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah,
of course. The thing about law also fascinated me, that they're simultaneously grasping at some kind of order, right? It's almost like we want order in our world, as chaotic as it is, and even as arbitrary as it is, we still want rules that basically guide our relationships with each other. It's almost kind of funny to call it a very, very weak example of the NAP, right? The non-aggression principle. It's not too much of that, but it's a little bit of that because they want that order in their lives to be able to, not have to worry about Brutus stabbing them in the back, literally. So I found that fascinating because then they went to the point of, well, if they're old, we're not going to kill old Jews. We're going to send them to some kind of concentration camp and they can just live out their lives. And maybe it's just for the propaganda purposes, right? They can show these old people in retirement and doing all right. And I've seen some of those videos, but that seems kind of like it's like, why are you doing that for everybody else that's old? Why don't you just kill everybody? And it's like, well, we'll let old people stay in these camps
or ghettos. Yeah.
Ghettos. And we'll send everybody else to the East. And if you're strong enough, we'll put you to work and we'll just work you until you die. And then we'll kill the others. And then of course the issue in the story moves to who are we going to be sending? If you're 100% Jewish, however they figure that out, then you're going to go. But what if you're, mother was Jewish and your father is German, just natural German. Now you're half Jewish. Now what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And that's what all these Nuremberg rules and laws were about, how to draw that line between who's acceptable and who's not acceptable. And maybe you're in a gray area where we're not going to, send you to a concentration camp, but you're not going to have the same privileges as full-fledged Aryan Germans. And it's fascinating that they would sort of argue about those points of law, even though, of course, the underlying argument was being made by a couple of them. One is, hey, we need the workers, so we can't get rid of these workers. And another one was, what are you going to do about the properties? If you have a half Jew that you send off to the extermination camps, who's going to inherit the property? Is it going to be the German side of that person? And are they going to wonder what happened to that person? And that's going to open up a whole can of worms.
And the divorces. Yeah, he talked about this bureaucratic nightmare that they were going to create by going through with this, with those laws that were of course, immoral and ridiculous, but that were on the books that they were trying to adhere to. And back to Robert's point, you know, they're going to call something like this, give everyone free gumdrops law, but it's really going to like kill puppies or something. Like that's how these things kind of work. They name them the exact opposite of what they do. I think that's kind of like the back of the napkin, like interpretation of most laws, like the Patriot Act, not so patriotic.
If we don't mind, I wouldn't mind talking about one of my favorite, I can't really call it a scene in the film, but it is my one of my favorite bits in the film. When they all arrive at the house and they're all sitting around the table and they've all kind of mingled a little bit beforehand, but they're all sitting down and the main general guys arrived and he asks everybody to introduce themselves. And they go around and they give their titles, you know, these big bureaucratic titles. And they tell you, you know, where they're from or what section of the government they're a part of. And then there's sometimes where they even have to explain to these other bureaucrats the purpose of their organization and what they actually do. Like there's so many levels and layers and little offshoots of this bureaucratic monster that they're like, who are you? You're the bureau arch minister of the whatever chancellery, something, something, something. And it's like, we do X, Y, and Z. And it's like, oh, I didn't even know we had to do that X, Y, and Z. And we're talking to other bureaucrats who also have to justify their existence. And it was almost comedic for me in that here you have all these people with made up titles and justification jobs, essentially, kind of justifying themselves to other people with made up jobs. And it just shows the ridiculousness of the bureaucracy and the way they'll just make up titles and jobs for people to do as long as they're spending money, because that's the important thing.
Yeah, yeah. Like I'm of the Bureau of the 4-year plan. That was, of course, the comedic foil, because he kept saying that as he introduced himself to people. And they were like, this guy is useless. What the hell? And then the Coppler guy is like, well, I'm for the 1,000-year plan. So there, you know?
Yeah, and they're all kind of jockeying for importance. Like you were saying earlier, Daniel, it's like, yeah, we're all going to try and control this. And my voice is going to be heard and how we're going to do this. And then, yeah, they just went around the table. And then ultimately the general was like, yeah, but nah, we already did this.
Yeah, that's the other thing about it. And this kind of ties back to the point you brought up, Dennis, where they're going to spare like the older Jews and put them in these retirement ghettos, and anyone who'd been awarded some like something for maybe fighting in World War I, possibly they were going to go to these retirement camp things as well. But that also felt sort of like Heydrich was parceling out information that wasn't actually going to happen. He was trying to move the group along to realizing that these little half-hearted solutions weren't going to solve their problem and move them more to accepting the idea of actually exterminating and just killing everybody and wiping them out, you know, off the face of the earth, basically. Right. And I think it was intended to get them to kind of buy into it so that it was more acceptable by the end of this. Hey, this has already happened. We've already decided this. And I'm just getting you to the point of accepting it. Like, oh yeah, those mobile gas unit trucks, they already exist. Oh yeah, those permanent camps that can do, you know, 2,400 in an hour, they already exist, or they're being built or something like that. Like these things are already in motion. And we're just here to make sure that you know who's really calling the shots here.
I would agree. I think you mentioned earlier that it was really kind of him looking at Heydrich, looking at this group and saying, you guys need to understand the SS is now in charge based on this letter from Goring. And so that's the entree into him sort of making sure that whatever disputes they have about how this is going to work out, the SS is going to be the ultimate arbiter of this. And, you know, maybe he makes some comments about, yes, maybe they'll go to the place, I can't remember the name, but Theresienstadt, and they'll do that. And yes, we'll note that there's some exemption, but he does cut that off a lot. He says, no, we're not going to do that. He's very vehement about the sterilization proposal, saying that some were saying, well, if we just sterilize half Jews, then we don't have to worry about, you know, that further degrading the German blood. And he's very much against that. And it's because he thinks it'll take too long. And I don't know if that's something that's coming more from him and Himmler, because I wanted to bring this up. This might be a good point to bring this up. Historian David Irving gets lambasted a lot as being a Holocaust denier. And he's not really a Holocaust denier, except that he turns out to know an awful lot about what happened during World War II. He's written, I don't know, four or five books, history books, very well regarded in the history community, speaks German, knows German, reads German, goes after original documents. And he always argues that when they use terms like evacuation, that strikes him as odd, because his view, and I don't know if this is right, but his view is that, you know, when the Germans documented what they were doing, they were very precise about what they were saying, you know, about what they were doing. They're very precise in their language. And this is, to him, a little bit weird. And then he also published, I think I sent one of the links, published a letter that's in German that's written by somebody in Hitler's inner group, who is talking about how Hitler was adamant that the Jewish problem needed to be deferred until after the war, which kind of makes sense to us as we watch this movie, because it comes up a couple of times. It's like, hey, you can't take our workers. We need them to make arms. We need them to build roads. We can't use the trains because we need it for the war effort. And there's this letter, and it's from the letter was from a couple months after this meeting, sometime later in the spring, where the guy is relating how Hitler saying, no, we've got to defer all the Jewish question until after the war, which, you know, makes sense to us. And that kind of makes this seem more like an effort on the part of Himmler, you know, to kind of bluff people into thinking, no, the SS really is in charge of this. Goering has told us that, and everybody else. And these are all middle management people that are at this meeting. They just got to go along with it.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. It kind of plays into the whole like power play narrative from Heydrich, right? Because what better way to bluff than that point that he made where, what was it? The doctor, Kritzinger, he was like, no, I've had this discussion with the Führer, and he said that he's denied that any of this type of thing will happen. And Heydrich says, well, yeah, and he will continue to deny that these things are happening. Now, not only is that like, well, of course, you know, he's for PR purposes going to deny it, but what better way to, if you're going to seize the reins of this, even if the Führer knows or doesn't know, you're going to bluff everyone else into believing that, yeah, this is what Hitler wants to have happen, but you can't question him on it because he'll deny it. So like the fact that I'm saying it right now is all that's needed for it to be the truth. So I'm sort of left wondering, like, was this just a case of Himmler and Goering and Heydrich, for whatever reason, getting this kind of machine in motion, and it wasn't necessarily Hitler who was like the one pulling the strings?
Yeah, I think, I think it's one of those things you could say, well, after the fact, Hitler might have said, oh, yeah, okay, that was a good thing you did. But I think the story is maybe a little bit more believable if we sort of think about Himmler's, the way Himmler operated. Himmler was always sort of looking to, you know, advance his power. Even at the end, he tried to take control of the government just before Hitler killed himself. And then Hitler, sent some kind of a note about he should be shot on sight or something. But I could believe that his machinations are at work. Not that Hitler didn't want to get rid of the Jews, he did, but was he really on board with the mass extermination during the war with Russia? You know, that I could kind of buy into the argument that that might have been something a little bit more pushed by Hitler and Heydrich.
Yeah, and that's another interesting point that you bring up is that they're trying to advance into Russia. I think it was called Operation Barbarossa. And just like Napoleon, they got caught in the Russian winter and were unable to advance and were stymied and being repelled. I think that the most casualties were Russian in the entire World War II.
That's correct.
So it's not like it was just the winter. Of course, the Russians were fighting back. We did a movie, Enemy at the Gates, a while back, earlier this year. That was a pretty good discussion on that. But that was also like going on while this conference was going on. So they're struggling in Russia. The United States has entered the war and they're talking about this other issue. And yeah, it makes sense to me that if you're really trying to win a war, you're not going to divert all of these resources. You know, not that central planning is great, but if you're in the position of being a central planner, why would you divert all these resources and destroy this labor pool? Like that one guy keeps talking about, where am I going to get my labor from? We're already short staffed. We're already having difficulties meeting these production quotas and all these things. By the way, side note, everyone, the Nazis weren't capitalists. They're capitalists in just name only, or in, de facto ownership, right? Like the name on the certificate was, oh yeah, it's a private ownership, but it was totally directed by the government. It's fascism, it's socialism. The Nazis were socialists. It's not just in the name, it's what they actually were, just to put a point on that. What the hell was I talking about? But oh yeah, so it brings up the idea of like, why would you actually divert all these resources if you were struggling in this war? If you wanted to win this war, you wouldn't then shift all this focus onto this extermination effort, right?
Well,
doesn't make sense.
But if they actually believed that they were really struggling in the war, like you see this also in Japan, and you see it, I think, pretty much any losing country.
We saw it in last week, Full Metal Jacket, The Stars and Stripes. It was like, oh, talk about how great the war's going. And oh, how many kills, and they killed
the general. Propaganda works on everybody, including the soldiers for morale purposes, including a lot of the, even in one point, at one point in this film, they talk about how good the war is going. And they're like, we don't have time for this propaganda talk. We're here to talk real talk. I forget the exact line, but yeah, there's a, absolutely. It would depend on whether they thought that those resources were really even needed over in the East, because there's so much fanatical fervor and belief in your righteous cause and the German know-how and the German ability and the power of the German man, that do you really even consider the fact that you could lose, or that these people would really be needed? I think they had longer ideas. They were really talking about their 1,000-year Reich. And in order for them to have this 1,000-year Reich, you got to get rid of all these Jews and all these undesirables. It very much goes down to, or goes back to, the ideas of eugenics. And Hitler was a big fan of the eugenics movement in the United States back in the 20s, where hundreds and maybe even thousands of people in Appalachia and other places were snatched up and forcibly sterilized. We're talking about like sheriffs would come to a family, grab people that were known to be mentally deficient, meaning, just not that smart, whatever, take them to a hospital and injected with sterilizing agents. And Hitler thought this was a great thing. And a lot of science, he wasn't alone in his thinking. A lot of people thought that eugenics was a great way to move humanity forward by purging undesirable traits from the gene pool.
Wait. I just want to clarify something here. They were just listening to the scientists, right? Just following the science?
Yeah, it's following the science.
Okay, just to be clear. All right.
This is what you need to do, Daniel. You just follow the science. I don't care if it's immoral. You just got to do it for the greater good. Okay? Follow the science. So I think that I don't remember exactly what happened with where it was published or what have you, but I think Hitler's on record saying that, the eugenics movement in the United States is a really good idea, and that, this is how you do these things. There's positive eugenics and there's negative eugenics. Negative eugenics is obviously sterilizing people. Positive eugenics is where you take two good traits, you know, one trait in the dad and one good trait in the mother, and then you meet them together and you make an even better baby. But, you know, when you don't have time for that, you you have negative eugenics where you go around and you sterilize people and you kill people. So I think that they were looking towards a long future, and this was all part of an equally important task. Not only was winning the war in Asia important, but also setting up this 1,000-year Reich that was going to have to get rid of these undesirable foods, that's going to have a chance.
All right. So at the risk of like getting into a really weird space here, but when you were talking about desirable traits and undesirable traits and like breeding and whatnot, it made me think of like animal breeders and horses and different types of dogs and things like
right.
that. Like
eugenics, right?
Right. It's basically eugenics, but for animals. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can kind of see how that people knowing that breeding animals for certain traits would create like the Australian cattle dog, you know, and it has this like certain ability or whatever, and that they would try to apply that to humans. Now, it makes sense that you could do that on a certain level. I don't think that it's necessarily morally okay to do it. Like
morally okay to forcibly sterilize people? That's a bold stance, Daniel.
Well, like even the they talked
or even
about
positive
in the, you know, in the last couple of decades, like designer babies, like you can genetically modify the traits that offspring will have. And it became the, you know, premise for like a movie like Gattaca, right?
True. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it just makes it makes a certain level of sense. I'm not saying like I'm a proponent or anything, but yeah, I can kind of see where they're going with it.
Well, I mean, that is an interesting thing you bring up there, Daniel. Is it morally okay? I mean, to designer gene your baby? I mean, who
yeah,
else?
Yeah, I mean, they talk about it too, like, initially, of course, and this is often how, like, laws and regulations creep in, but they talk about it in the positive benefits of reducing harm or negative outcomes. So, like, oh, we'll do genetic therapy to eliminate certain types of cancer or certain propensities for
genetic disorders or things like that, yeah.
Right, right. But then it's a very slippery slope into, well, I want it to have this color of eyes and this color of hair.
7 feet tall, and yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, it gets weird. It gets real weird.
It does. It gets real weird. Absolutely, yeah. I'm not saying it's necessarily immoral, though. I mean, it is.
Well, it's a tool, and it can be used immorally, or it can be used morally. It's like a firearm in a certain way.
I mean, like if you were to change a baby so that it couldn't see or something like that. I mean, I'm just trying to go.
Well, it's because the other end of it would be like awareness of, oh, this isn't going to turn out how we want. Therefore, what do? You know, you have a final solution for that particular instance.
Well, let me ask you this question, Daniel. If you found out,
can of worms.
You found out that your baby had a 75% chance of being born with a genetic defect, let's say spina bifida. That's the first one that comes to mind. I know it's caused by other stuff, but whatever. Spina bifida, 75% chance. But there's a technique, process you can undergo to change the DNA in your little spermie and the DNA in the little eggy. And then there's a 99% chance that it'll work. And then the baby will be healthy. Do you do it?
I mean, if I believe those numbers... If I believe those scientists, right. That's, you know.
You got to believe the science, Daniel. Come on. That's what we've
learned. Yeah. I mean, it's tough because, like.
There are unintended consequences. We're not all experts. Genetics is a rapidly growing field. We're constantly learning new stuff. And who's to say that you fix one thing and you don't screw up another thing? I don't know.
Right. I mean, in one way, you could argue it's sort of like diet and exercise. Well, you would do these certain things to be healthy. So it sort of translates like, well, if you do this certain thing genetically, molecularly, you know, just change this little digit over on the DNA and then it'll be like a healthier outcome. But I don't know. I mean, it's kind of getting into playing God area. And that's a morally.
What we've learned from history is that playing God always works out well and it's always good. Daniel.
I will say a lot of this goes to the individuals making the choice for themselves, because who's in the best position to make that decision? But then there's certain areas where, like, okay, yeah, aggressively murdering somebody who wasn't aggressing against you, so a non-self-defense situation, no matter how much you wanted that person to be killed, doesn't mean that, oh, well, we can subjectively say, well, that was okay. You know, so there's like this, there's certain criteria. I'm not sure what they are. We need to have Colin Firth come out and write some laws for me so we can figure out what we're going to use to determine this, the response here. But I'm sure, Dennis, you got plenty to chew on there.
Well, it's the principal issue. It's you come up with Robert's idea about, well, if you have a technique to make sure that your kid doesn't get this particular disease, of course you do it. And everybody would probably agree with that. But then somebody else says, well, you know, now there's another technique that would give my kid a third arm, which I think will make, you know, make them very productive and valuable. And now suddenly you're into this area of, well, who's going to make that decision? You know, you can make it for yourself. You know, if you could go out and just have another arm surgically attached, mechanical or something that would benefit you, well, you can do that because you are in control of your own body. But do you do that for an embryo, for a kid that's going to be born? Therein lies the whole gray area. And does that mean that the state has to make decisions about that? And hopefully, you know, we don't have to worry about those issues, but it seems like that's exactly the kind of debate that, you know, leads us down that kind of road.
Yeah. And my starting position is that the state is not only unnecessary, but is also immoral. So no matter what the scenario, I would deign to the voluntariness and the free market coming up with a solution that would be, not to say that it's going to be perfect, but the alternative is coercion, and that I cannot abide.
Is this a free market Jewish solution? Is that what you guys are talking about? Sorry, I missed a bit.
Yeah, you missed the most important and exciting moment of this show in the history of this show.
Actually, I'd like to go back to what Robert was talking about there, because this gets to the point I was making at the beginning, and that is, you know, Hitler doesn't like exist in a vacuum. He's a product of his time. Obviously, his involvement in World War I and obviously the Treaty of Versailles. We should have listened to Keynes, you know, when it came to the Treaty of Versailles, not to anything else, but at least to that.
Yeah, thanks for adding that.
We got to expand our audience a little bit here. And then the whole thing with the eugenics and the fact that, yes, that was a big movement in the progressive era. And Hitler is just sort of picking up on that and, you know, pushing the envelope, really. And so it, you know, really, we have to kind of keep those kind of issues in mind in terms of what is really going on. I mean, it's so easy to just fall into the sort of the, you know, the consensus view that, well, he's just evil incarnate. Whenever that kind of comes up, not that it comes up very often, I usually say, oh, you know, he was a vegetarian. So, you know, that's a good thing, right? You know, he loved dogs. So, you know, so that's a nice thing. And didn't Stalin and Mao kill more people than Hitler ever killed? You know, but we don't treat them the same way. So, you know, that I find it kind of interesting that, you know, it's really easy for us to vilify him to 100%. And, you know, maybe he only deserves 90%. You know, it's like, okay, we're still going to vilify him, but, you know, it's like, it's so easy to lump on all these additional things into him. Maybe it makes us feel better, right? It's like we can go about screwing up the world in our own particular way because, you know, we're not Hitler.
Yeah, it's absolutely important to not view Hitler as this whitewashed, unique evil that it was this random one-off chance. Like, what are the odds that this would happen? And more that he's a product of his times and he's the product of people believing in political authority. And that's what happened.
Right. But of course, that's not what we get. What we get is, well, he's the ultimate evil. And anyone who utters anything similar or even questions anything or even drinks water is potentially a Nazi. And I think that that also ties into this concept or this idea from what we're sort of shown in media and in education that, well, how did Hitler achieve what he achieved? what did he do to get people to go along with it? It was propaganda. It was coming up with this common enemy. It was certain rhetoric started to resonate, and it was repeated enough. That was the Goebbels thing, right? You repeat a lie long enough, or the bigger the lie, the more you can make it believable. So that's sort of transformed into this now restriction on any speech that is not PC or approved or okay, to be said on social media, in television, in any respect. And now it's like okay to punch somebody for something they said, even if it's like this benign thing 10 years ago, 5 years ago, but now they're a Nazi for saying it. And the person who's doing this punching or the silencing is a hero or very virtuous. And it's all to prevent another Hitler and another Holocaust. And I think it's a very convenient all-purpose excuse for fighting Nazis by becoming Nazis themselves.
It's the ultimate get out of jail free card. Well, I'm fighting the ultimate evil, so the ends justify the means. If I got to punch 50 Nazis in the face, aren't I the greatest person ever? Yeah, I'm kicking this grandma in the face, but you know, she's probably a Nazi too. It's really ridiculous that once you vilify your enemy, make them the most evil person in the world, it justifies your own actions, just like the people in this movie. They vilify the Jews as to, most of them at the table want to make them as this unhuman, inhuman boogeyman character, but then the Colin Firth character is like, no, they're actually quite clever, actually quite smart. They are human, but I hate them too, by the way. I'm just as much of a hater as you are.
We all want to
see him exterminated.
That was a bit of a fake out when he starts talking about them, because you're like, oh, well, maybe he's got the like, an actual like intellectual perspective on this whole thing. But he's like, no, I actually hate them more than you do because you hate them for dumb reasons. I hate them for really smart reasons.
I hate them for the right reasons. You guys are just stupid.
But anyway, just to tie this to current events, there was this guy driving a truck in Portland, Oregon. Apparently he was trying to prevent somebody else from who was being attacked.
A trans woman.
And this peaceful protesting group, attacked him and made him run off the road and crash. And they pulled him out of his vehicle and kicked him and punched him and whatever while he was prone on the ground. I heard some rumors that he might've died. I don't know. But the people who perpetrated this, the main guy who did it, he posted on his Instagram, I think, like, oh, I might get in trouble for murder tonight because I attacked a racist. So he was justifying
anybody that opposes him. Anybody that opposes them, since they are pro anti-racist, anybody that opposes them has to be a racist, right?
By default.
So anybody that doesn't want me to kick this trans woman in the face is clearly a racist. It's the ultimate get out of jail free, unfalsifiable bullshit.
Yeah. So I was. It's been all over social media the last couple of days, and it makes me not want to go anywhere near the cities these days. I'll tell you that.
Well, I sent you that one video about all the people leaving the cities, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've seen it, too, because we've been looking at properties like, you know, rural areas. Prices going up like crazy, like mad. And I'm like, wait, aren't we in like a frickin' depression here?
Yeah, not where I live.
Yeah, it's just like nobody knows it yet. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, this might be where we might be in the middle of something very, very big that we'll look back on in a few years and go, oh, yeah.
Yeah. May you live in interesting times. Well, I'm sorry. Let's tie it back to the movie a little bit, and then we'll need to start winding down because we have gone almost an hour already. I can't believe because I feel like there's more to say about this. But Dennis, why don't you take us? You got any notes or any other points you want to bring up?
I was just going to add to what you were commenting there about the attack in Portland, because one of the questions you had asked earlier is, you know, why the Jews? And I was thinking, well, it is interesting because to the extent that they're just scapegoats, what happens when you run out of them? Don't you have to go to the next scapegoat and you have to go to the next one and the next one? And pretty soon you end up with the proverbial, you're eating your own. And it seems like that kind of underlies was going on there, and also what we see going on around us now. I mean, this idea that we're not even going to, you know, see what the guy was trying to do. We're just going to beat him up because that's what we want to do. It's really like brown shirts matter, not Black Lives Matter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that they adopt Nazi tactics to fight Nazis or scarecrow Nazis. And it's basically anyone I want to attack is a Nazi because I said they are. And therefore it's okay for me to do the thing. Like you were saying, it's a get out of jail free card.
They can never be wrong.
Yeah, you can never be wrong. Hopefully there's some repercussions to this because it seems as though in Portland and even in Seattle, there's a lot of leeway being given to property crimes and violent crimes happening. And then even the media is complicit in this, saying, oh, they're mostly peaceful. Well, sure, they're mostly peaceful. They've only part-time murdered people, part-time attacked people, part-time burnt down buildings.
Hey, serial killers are 99.9% peaceful too. They're not actively killing someone at the moment all the time.
Right. Rapists are 99.9% not raping. I mean,
I was thinking, how many Nazis actually killed somebody?
Well, I mean, if all the military were Nazis, there's a couple of million people, but.
Well, not all the military was, but still all the party members. I mean, they had millions of party members, you know, maybe it was 5,000 that actually killed anybody.
Yeah. And actually the German army in World War II was a highly diverse army. I mean, they had tons and tons of conscripts from all over Europe. It was a force made up of all kinds of different people, all kinds of Croats and Poles and all kinds of different people that couldn't necessarily talk to one another, but they were all united underneath the German flag.
Well, and this the idea that it was some sort of a monolithic state behind Hitler, I think, is another sort of mistake that we make. And I think this movie kind of illustrates that, you know, the purpose is to cow all these other interests into the interest that is being promoted by the SS. And if you sort of think behind the scene here, it's like, well, that's because there are a lot of other interests. They may all be shades of fascism, but they aren't all in agreement. I don't think there's any mention in the movie of the Night of the Long Knives, if you're familiar with that.
The Kristallnacht. Yeah.
No. This is the Night of the Long Knives is where Hitler had arranged to arrest all these guys from the SA, which is the paramilitary arm of the Nazi party, who basically rivaled him in power and then executed most of them the same night. And this was a way for him to consolidate power. He wasn't killing his enemies. He was killing his friends that also enjoyed power. And I think that some of what we're seeing in this movie is that, yes, there are these different centers of power that exert themselves. And, you know, Heydrich is basically trying to cow them into his particular sphere of influence.
Okay, that's interesting. So it's almost like a false flag event. Like, I think that was one of the things that brought Hitler to power was the Reichstag fire, where they blamed it. This is getting to my Alex Jones here, but they blamed it on this like mentally retarded guy and made him be this villain who had started this fire. But it was to, again, galvanize the people against, oh, look, we've been attacked. What are we going to do? You know,
and that was against the communist. I think that particular event, they were going against the communist. The Kristallnacht was predicated on the assassination of the German ambassador in France, I believe. Hmm. And it was, you know, some Jewish person that was, you know, angry about what was going on. And so they used that, leveraged that into the Kristallnacht.
Yeah, it's amazing how they'll often leverage these events to their benefit. Like Rahm Emanuel says, never let a crisis go to waste. And we can always implement these things we've had on the sidelines that we couldn't otherwise pass. Also, I'm very prescient for common for current times.
And it's just the fact
now we don't need a crisis; we can manufacture our own.
Hey, now don't get us censored here.
I'm just going off of Robert's initial comments.
All right, Robert, you wanted to chime in?
Oh yeah, I was going to say something, then I forgot what it was.
All right. Well, why don't we go to final notes, and then if you remember what you got, tack it on at the end of your final notes here.
Okay. Well, this isn't my summary and review, but one last thing that stood out to me about this I wanted to talk about real quick or whatever. When at the end of the film, all the different Nazis are given a little postscript about what happened to them after the war. And this one stood out to me. This was for SS Colonel Kark Schongarth. And it says that he was convicted by a British military court for a, quote, terror program without higher authority, and that he was executed in February of 46. But it's interesting because, well, he was convicted in a British military court, which I'm sure has different standards and different crimes for it. So if someone had of higher rank had authorized this activity that Schongarth had done, then he couldn't have necessarily been convicted for this because it's a terror program without higher authority. It would have been okay as long as someone else had, at the top above him had been like, yeah, okay, go ahead and commit this terror. But it's funny that the military court has this distinction because they need this distinction because otherwise everything they do would qualify. Because everything militaries do necessarily is going to be terror to somebody, right? You're going to invade some territory and boss everybody around and point guns in people's faces and kill them. That's terror. But as long as somebody, as long as there's a chain of command where it comes from the top, then it's okay, right? Because states absolve people of their immoral behavior somehow, some way, through some mystical process that nobody quite understands.
This must be before the Nuremberg defense was sort of like used or trotted out as like, well, just following orders isn't enough. Because that kind of is counter to that.
Right, it is kind of counter to that. This is, I guess this is a different court, so it's a different standard. This is
right.
The military court versus the, I guess, civilian court of the Nuremberg trials.
Right, or international court. I don't know if it was it was the Nuremberg trials, but was it conducted by the UN? I don't know enough about it. I want to say there's something at the Hague too in Belgium.
Yeah, that's where the World Court is, yeah. At the Hague, I think.
Yeah.
But I think the Nuremberg thing was just organized by the winning powers, right? The US and the British and the French and the Russians too.
Okay, right. Now, I'm going to praise, you're not going to believe this, Robert.
Oh, I'm going to believe it.
Kamala Harris for a moment.
What? Wait, okay, no, you're right. I'm not going to believe it.
All right, so she
first of all, had... Kamala? Did you just say Kamala? Because that's racist, I heard. Just say Kamala.
I know Tucker got in trouble for not pronouncing her name right. I don't know how to pronounce her name. It's because I've heard her name a bunch, but I don't care enough to like know how to say it right. I'm sorry.
How dare you, dirty racist.
I think she's a terrible person. However, in this one instance, and this will be controversial for most people, I think she was correct in this. She had before, she was a senator, right? Or is a senator. She had before her someone from, I think the CIA maybe. And she was saying to them something along the lines of, oh, you were, you know, working against this certain group and they were doing something that you would qualify as terror. And she got the guy to admit, yeah, this activity would be terrorist activity to politically motivate somebody to do something. And she's like, well, what do you do? And just kind of let it hang there in this like baited question. And it was sort of this rhetorical, like, okay, I've just set you up and then said this thing and I've made my point. So in that respect, I think that she did make a fine point in that most of what government agencies do could be described as terror. And I've heard that there's a difficulty in having the government actually define what terror is because they can't define it without identifying something that they do as being it.
Indeed, they do, sir. This is why you have these hypocrisies. And they couch things in different terms and obfuscate with language.
Which is why you cannot trust language. That's the thing I've learned from this movie. All right. Any final notes before we get into the final summary and review? Give a score. I don't know what kind of gradient to give to this. We'll just go out of 10. How about that?
Okay, yeah, I'll go first. So Conspiracy. I hadn't heard of the director before, but he did a perfectly fine job. Although, I mean, you film it in a beautiful location and you got all these sharp dressed gentlemen, you know, looking good. Yeah, you got a murderer's row of acting talent on display. These guys are all, they don't really necessarily have complex characters, and there's not like a traditional plot where characters learn something and grow. There's nothing like that. But it is a fascinating kind of character study in the sense that you have all these different personalities all discussing this very uncomfortable topic in otherwise normal situations. I mean, you and I don't get together and talk about how we're going to kill 11 million people. Nobody does. Very rarely does it happen, but it happened in this situation. And how do you behave in that situation? And then there's all these different power differentials and plays going on, and you want to seem important, and you need to have your opinion be recognized and have people listen to you. But do you really want to be the guy that's leading the discussion on how do we kill 11 million people? Well, maybe you do. If you think 11 million people are the bane of your existence, you've been propagandized to believe that these people, if you get rid of them, then everything will be better. At no point in the film do any of them, except for maybe the one guy who's talking about the labor pool, but even then he's like talking about having them like build, like taking some banker guy and having him like build a shed or something. He's not talking about the division of labor that we talk about, where people who are skilled at a thing do that thing really, really well. At no point in the film do they talk about the Jews as being good, skilled, important economic actors. At no point. They don't run businesses well that you would patronize. At one point, the guy that's running the show, not the general, but the other guy, he talks about how he got like instructions on speaking from a rabbi. I guess that's the only time where he actually talks about like some value that a Jewish person, Eichmann, some value that a Jewish guy provided to him. But at no other time do they talk about all the important economic achievements that Jewish people provide, that how they are very industrious and intelligent. And at one point, the doctor guy talks about them being intelligent and cunning. But it's all kind of like in a negative way, not that, hey, these people are really smart. They can solve problems. They can provide value in the market. You know, these might be good people to have on our side. No, it's all about how, you know, we just need to get rid of these people because they're the dragging us down. They're the yoke around our neck, and we need to get rid of them, and then our lives will be better. It's always about vilifying the other, and then somehow we'll be better because we're the victim, and it's just these other people's fault, not our own ability to do or not do things. It's an interesting psychological look into the human mind, and it's to treat these people as not human and uniquely evil is a disservice. You can learn all kinds of things from these people, just like you can from people that don't go around killing 11 million people. So it's a fascinating film. I don't know exactly how much of it really, really happened, like dialogue and whatnot, but I think that the writers did a fantastic job giving them some character and making them human people, human characters. At no point does it seem like this is too bizarre. This would not happen. This is very much a real feeling story of people that are actually just given this task, this horrific task by this person who they've all kind of signed up to follow. So, you know, it's really good. You should check it out if you haven't seen it. I don't think we've actually even spoiled anything. It's just, I mean, we talked about things that happened in the film, but it's really just a whole bunch of guys talking, sitting around a table talking. But the real value I got out of it was actually watching it, not necessarily what they were discussing. But, well, what they're discussing is important, but I don't think I spoiled anything by telling what they discuss. It's the way they talk about it that's really revealing.
It's so, almost the horror of it is how nonchalant they can be talking about something. So,
yeah, they turn pink.
Yeah, and they laugh about it.
And they laugh about it. It's a it's nightmare fuel, but it is absolutely human story. Like, even if you say you're not capable of this, somebody was, and they weren't born evil. So you have to recognize that. So anyway, I'd give this like an 8.5. It's really good. Check it out.
All right, very good. I'm surprised you didn't go with the dog whistle of the 8.8, Robert.
I'm not going to go that far into your territory.
All right. Dennis, your final summary and then a score. Hopefully not an 8.8. I don't want to get us banned off of all platforms. Maybe just one or two.
Okay. Apparently I don't understand that reference, but I kind of agree with some of the things Robert had to say about this. I mean, it's a fascinating sort of point in time. The movie is about 90 minutes long, and so was the conference. So it's not something that they rushed through in terms of the movie making. The actual literal conference back in 1942 only lasted 90 minutes. And so that is kind of an interesting also element to think about in terms of, you know, how can they make these kinds of decisions so quickly? And of course, I think the main decision is just that they're allowing the SS to control this particular process. So, you know, there's a lot of other things, a lot of other moving parts here, but it's the control that is really the key there. And what I like about the movie is just how horrific it is in terms of what the state can do when it has this kind of power. And, you know, it's like, how do you fight it? I mean, the only way to fight it is to literally fight it, but that they can just treat this as just one more problem. It's like, well, we're, you know, we're worried about how do we produce enough widgets for next year? And it's just like a big math problem. And
we have a storage problem.
Yes, we have a storage problem. How do we get rid of all these Jews that, you know, we say we're going to get rid of them, and, you know, we want to allow Germans to expand out into some of these other areas. And of course, the 11 million figure, just to mention, 2.5 million come from Poland, and then 5 million are what they expect to come out of Russia. So assuming that they win the war with Russia, that's going to be 5 more million. So 7.5 million are just from those two places. The rest of Europe doesn't have but like tens of thousands, maybe a couple hundred thousand Jews in each of these various countries. But the idea that they can just treat that like a math problem and, you know, just, well, all we got to do is, you know, follow through with this. Once we understand who's in control, who's in charge, where the authority comes from, then we can just go about carrying out our business, right? Because they're all, when they leave, the guys that are going back to Poland have been reassured that the Polish Jews are going to go first. The guy that's going back to the 4-year plan is thinking that they're going to be able to still have workers to help implement the 4-year plan and so on. So everybody, you know, is going to go away and they're going to go back to their business, and they're never going to touch any of the dirty part of this, except for maybe a couple of the soldiers that were there from Poland and from the east out in the Russian provinces that they'd already taken over. So that, to me, the big thing is the power of the state, how it can become so obscene in such a sort of normal sort of way. I mean, it should strike us as bizarre, and yet it should strike us as, no, that's just the way these kinds of things unfold, to the point where, you know, suddenly we're facing with this kind of, Holocaust as it's described. So I think that makes this an excellent movie. I mean, when I first saw it, I didn't know anything about it. And I've watched it, three or four times. I find it quite compelling in terms of getting engaged in the issues as they're expressed. Now, they don't know any of the conversation among the various participants. They know that some of the discussion had to do with who's a Jew and who's not a Jew and who's a half Jew and who's not a half Jew. And they know that Stuckert did make some complaints about the law and whether they were following the law. And so that shows up in the summary document, but we don't really know what the dialogue is. But I think the dialogue is just sparkling here in terms of drawing out these issues in a way that is, I would say, quite fair. It would be real easy to go over the top and just make everybody seem like like a horrible monster that maybe they are, but I think that the dialogue, they really did an excellent job in that regard. So I'm going to give this like an 8.79. I don't know what that means, but I think that's good.
Yeah, Dennis, you make a really good point about how far removed everybody at this conference was from the actual act of murder. It seems like the more removed you are, the easier it is to order the deaths of millions of people. I don't think hardly, maybe a few of those guys could have actually pulled the trigger a bunch of times. But most of those people, I don't think if you put like, you know, a couple of men and women and children of Jewish people, that they were just going to like start gunning them down or stabbing them or beating them. I think there's bureaucrats who are perfectly okay with evil in the abstract sense of, okay, I can rationalize this and this is going to be a good thing. But if I actually had to do it myself, I don't think that these people would be doing that.
Well, even Eichmann talks about how he got sick. Yeah. At the with the trucks, you know, when they were gassing the people in the trucks, and it's like, yeah, he's not going to do that again.
Yeah, and that was just him watching it. Probably he wasn't actually doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the one guy who got sick, and he blamed it on the cigar, and that was just based on the discussion. And it made me almost wonder if they put something in the food to make everyone uncomfortable, because it seemed as if Heydrich and Eichmann weren't partaking of any of it. But it might have been like a way to weaken the resistance of the other participants in the conference.
I think all they really had were pastries, because it was just a short 90-minute meeting.
Yeah, in the movie they have like three courses or whatever throughout the meeting. Like, bring in the food, snap, snap. All right.
Oh, well, by the way, before I interrupt Daniel again, the 8.8 stands, it's 8. The eighth letter of the alphabet is H. So in neo-Nazi circles, 8.8 stands for 8.8 stands for Heil Hitler.
I see. So yeah. Don't do 8.8 and don't wave at the end.
Right. And then there's something to do with 14. I don't know what the 14 stands for, but 1488 is apparently like double bad.
I don't remember what 14 is. It sounds familiar. Like I should know it, but.
If we did American History X, I'm sure it's in there.
Most likely.
Yeah. All right. Well, so I guess it's down to me for my final summary review, and I'll echo on a lot of things that have already been said and also was said by our previous guest, John Reed, because he also really enjoys this movie, Conspiracy. It's really amazing how interesting you can make virtually a one-room play, and you've got some really great acting talent. You've got a lot of really insightful dialogue, and the banality with which, and the sterility of how they've approached this is pretty amazing. And Branagh's performance is so good because he is very menacing in a subtle way. Like, you can tell in those moments where he takes these people aside and has those talks with them that he's not just saying, no, you need to agree with me. It's more like, you need to agree with me, or you might catch the interest of this other group, or this other guy who's going to kill you. But he doesn't have to say it in so many words. And you can feel the gravity of it. And so I think that this is very well executed. And it's a very interesting film. It's well done. It's been recommended a couple of times for me to watch. And I was a little bit reluctant, not only to watch a movie about Nazis, but then to have it on the show. Just because, I don't know, it seems like it's a taboo subject just at all these days, but I think that we had a very, very good conversation about this. And I don't know. I feel like if our show was longer, we'd have more to talk about, but it's only as long as, well, it's already been long, but it's only about an hour. It's supposed to be about an hour. So I will go with the 8.8 on this. I'm not dog whistling. I'm just saying it's almost a 9. It's a really good film, and you should all check it out. It's available on HBO. And also available for purchase on Amazon. You can click on our links on our page and purchase it, or have HBO and watch it for no additional charge other than the monthly HBO fee. So that is our discussion on Conspiracy tonight. We're going to have a little bit of bonus content where we go a little bit deeper into certain things. Who knows what? That's Kathleen Turner Overdrive, available for our Patreon supporters at lastnighters.com/Patreon. You can also now find us on YouTube, patreon.com/lastnighters. We just got the domain name verification process complete. So subscribe to us there. I don't know if you listeners of the podcast are aware, but there's video so you can see our ugly faces. Not Dennis, you're a great looking guy, but Robert and I are horrendous looking. So people, check it out at YouTube. Just see how bad
radio.
Just see how terrible we are. Go to the YouTube, subscribe, click the bell icon down below or up here, or I don't know how they say this, but do that and we'll get more subscribers and some good things happen out of that. So next week, Robert, we're going to have a guy on who I've wanted to have on for a long time. He's semi-famous on the interwebs. Gets a fair amount of traction. It's the meme policeman. So what he does is he takes memes and dissects their arguments with facts and evidence to either bolster the message of the meme or to deconstruct it. And he's really, really good at it. He gets a lot of social media attention from this. He's been on the Tom Wood Show or is about to be. He just told me that he's either been on or is about to be. So we'll post that on his show notes page for the movie we're doing with him, which is The Whodunit Caper, starring James Bond, Knives Out, available for streaming on the old Amazon Prime. Apparently, it's a super good movie. People have recommended it to me multiple times that I just need to watch it. We need to do it. And so we're going to be doing it next week with The Meme Policeman.
Very good. Yes, that's a movie I saw a little bit ago, I think about a month or two ago, and I had a really good time watching it. So I look forward to our discussion.
All right, very good. And Dennis, I hope you can stick around a little bit longer. I really appreciate you being on for this episode, for suggesting this movie, and for the great talk that we've had tonight. I want to remind people that you've been on for The Day the Earth Stood Still and Soylent Green. Those were both excellent, and I hope that we have you back on. It could be another Nazi movie. It's fine. You handled yourself well. Or it could be another classic. I was suggesting earlier that we could do something like Gaslight or The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which I think either one or both would be good to do at some point in the future.
Now, note there's four versions of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
And there's two or three versions of Gaslight. So we'll have to pick probably just one of each. But
is there a Charlton Heston Body Snatchers version?
No, but there's a Daniel Craig.
Oh, the most recent one. Okay.
In fact, he was filming that movie at the time they announced he was going to be James Bond. So that was his last unknown movie.
And I hope it remains unknown. I don't think we're going to be doing that one. All right. Well, thank you, audience, for joining us. And Robert, you can list off a couple of suggestions, things that they might want to do if they like what we do here.
Yeah, if you like what we do, you want to see more, you can click right down here to see more. And you can
see more butts.
I don't know who says that, but I just... from somebody. You can go to Trepster.com, buy some merch, which I need to update. I need to get some more stuff. There's all kinds of funny type stuff that has to do with current events that I'm completely missing out on. You can help us out on Patreon. You can leave us a review in Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe, like Daniel said, to our YouTube channel. You can interact with us on Facebook or social media. You can just tell us how we're wrong. Tell us how we're right. You can leave a good review, a bad review. We don't care. Just interact with us. Pretend like we exist. We do. We do exist, I think. Therefore, I am. I don't know.
Very well said, though quietly. Something is weird with your mic. But fortunately, we're at the end of the show, so we can move on to some Kathleen Turner Overdrive after this. And again, available for the Patreon supporters, lastnighters.com/Patreon. This has been our episode on conspiracy. You can find it at lastnighters.com/138 and also at the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. And we'll see you guys next week for Knives Out. And with that, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right. And if the show hasn't been long enough just yet, we've got more on the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This will just be a little bit longer. This is episode, 195 of the show. You can find the show notes more, actualanarchy.com/195. Now, I like to save a question for the end here. And this one kind of goes back to an episode we did with the anarcho-Christian a couple of years ago on Easter, where I asked the question, I had heard that one of the claims against the Jews was that they killed Jesus, and that was why people had ire for them. That was actually mentioned in this film, so I wasn't just making it up when we had the anarcho-Christian on. Robert, do you recall the moment in the movie, and was it when, what was his name, Stuckart was saying that was one of the dumb reasons to not like Jews, or one of the, I know a lot intellectually about why to dislike them, and this is one of those reasons. I forget he mentioned it, but I don't know if he was contrasting it with the...
I think he was saying it was a dumb reason, but I don't remember exactly. I think he was saying dumb. Because, yeah, I mean, even he realizes that prosecuting current people for ancient sins of other that other people did is stupid. So maybe he's got a leg up on all the reparations people. I don't know.
Right. Okay. Well, this might have been where I heard it before that episode. Because when I brought it up, when we were talking about, was it the Passion of the Christ or... Yeah, it was the Passion of the Christ episode. I asked this question and he had not heard of this, but it makes some sense. Like if you're going to come up with reasons to dislike people of a certain criteria, you're going to go back through the annals of history and be like, all right, what can we find? What can we pin on them? You know?
Sure. Yeah. And then the Pharisees were the ones that wanted Jesus killed. Right. But my argument was, well, wasn't that according to the plan? Didn't Jesus want to die or something like that?
Right.
He was born and whatever.
Right. And then there was the whole thing with picking Barabbas, right, to save him. And wasn't that, it was the Jews deciding who to save that was what ended up being Jesus being killed, right? So that was what they're blaming. They're blaming the Jews for choosing Barabbas, not for actually killing Jesus, but for doing something that didn't save Jesus, right? Is that the argument? Like, you didn't save him, therefore you killed him.
No, didn't they kind of, they had him locked up in their temple, right? And then they told Pilate to come get him, right? Is that what happened in that movie?
Oh, man, my Sunday school is like 35 years
ago. I could have sworn that he did something like he was preaching outside of a church or like a temple, and then that was what they were frowning upon. And, well, he was saying a whole bunch of stuff that they didn't like. And so then they were holding him. But then it was up to the Romans to actually prosecute in their court system, so to speak.
Legally, it was a very lawful thing.
It's a lot. I'm sure they were listening to the scientists at the time.
Oh man, we're going off the rails here. All right. Well, if it was just they didn't choose him over Barabbas, then I'd be like, okay, well, that's almost like this modern day, like, oh, you mentioned all these groups that you apologize to or inclusivity, like have on your list, but you missed this one. Therefore, you're evil and bad. Am I making sense? I'm probably
No, I'm not following you. Maybe Dennis knows what you're talking about right now.
I have no clue.
All right. Perfect way to end the show.
Except that this is even worse than the idea that the dialogue is all made up in conspiracy. It's like, well, none of this stuff about Jesus anybody knows about, right? It's like there are cryptic references and they're way later and everything else is just filled in. Who knows who killed what? Although, I mean, it gets to the issue of the scapegoating. It's like, well, maybe this is a good line to use to scapegoat Jews, right? It's like, well, they killed the Christ, but the Nazis weren't Christians. So it's like, okay, you know, the Christians will be the next ones on the scapegoat list.
That's interesting.
But they seem to want to pander to the Pope, though, right? And they're talking about the divorces and whatnot.
At least not upset him.
But again, it was all for political reasons. I mean, they have to deal with that particular center of power now. But you can bet that if things go their way in Russia, have you seen that? Oh, I was going to mention this during the main part. But have you guys seen the series, The Man in the High Castle?
I've seen the first season.
On Amazon. No. It's on Amazon Prime. It's based on a book by Philip K. Dick, who's fabulous. Except that they really extended his book in ways that he didn't write about, but I think they did it in a very good way. And the idea is that the Japanese and the Germans won World War II and they split up the United States. And at the end of season one and into season two, we spend a lot of time in Germany, which in Dick's book, we don't spend any time in Germany. It's all just with regard to Japanese. But we spend this time in Germany, and they paint a very interesting picture of, you know, that kind of is, well, here's where they would go, the next step and the next step and the next step, you know, if they had kept winning. And so it gets to the idea that I mentioned about the scapegoats. It's like, well, you use a scapegoat until you run out, then you use a new scapegoat.
Yeah, we've seen that with all the various wars on X and then Y and then Z, because you run out. And now we're on the ultimate war. I thought the war on terror was the ultimate war because it was like this nebulous, never defeatable enemy. But now it's the war on the unseen. It could be anywhere. It's going to get you.
Yeah.
I saw a meme. Speaking of memes, I saw a meme. It was a joke. I have a joke about COVID-19, but I'm not going to tell you because 99% of you won't get it.
And the 1% that do will probably survive it. All right. Well, that'll probably be the thing. That'll be the thing that gets this video kicked off of YouTube right there. None of the Nazi talk.
Well, there's a lawyer guy I like to watch called Viva Fry. And he calls it the My Sharona Cyrus in order not to trip YouTube censors.
Any algorithms, yeah. Don't get demonetized.
Well, we've probably said it too many times already. We're going to get caught. But hopefully everyone will be here next week to talk about Knives Out with the main policeman. And Dennis, thanks again for being our guest for this episode. This is episode 195, the Actual Anarchy Podcast. Find it wherever podcasts are sold for the price of free. And we'll have you back on in probably a couple of months for one of those other movies we were talking about. And we'll be back with Knives Out next week. And thank you, everyone. Maximum freedom. Peace out.
Yeah.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do 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 do.